You have a line to Congresswoman Gwen Moore on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Moore was on a bus tour, part of a congressional hearing in Milwaukee earlier this week, focused on the current challenges around affordable housing and the historical racial discrimination. So what is your story about living in Milwaukee? What have you and your family encountered with housing? 800-642-1234. Democratic U.S. Representative Gwen Moore of Wisconsin's 4th District includes parts of the Milwaukee metro area. She serves on the 14-member House Select Committee on Economic Disparity and Fairness and Growth, of which members were on this bus tour. Congresswoman Gwen Moore, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, good to be with you, Kate.
Good morning. Well, before we get into housing, I want to ask about how you are doing, your recent diagnosis with COVID, second time testing positive. How are you doing?
Well, I'm better today than I was yesterday, so I'm on the right trajectory. I don't have my booming voice for
you.
I hear that.
Yes. Well, I'm glad to hear that you're on the mend. Let's look at housing now. You returned to your home district, Milwaukee, this week, and Milwaukee's still one of the most extremely segregated cities in America, despite more than 50 years of the Fair Housing Act. How do you think Milwaukee has changed since you went to Congress?
Well, thank you so much for really just reviewing that history. I remember Vail R. Phillips, when she was the first female and black alderwoman in the city of Milwaukee. She introduced a fair housing bill, and it was defeated, 18-1 every time. And people might recall Father Crappie and Vail Phillips marching for fair housing. And, part of the problem is that we really need to do things that are proactive to reverse the kinds of causes of this. We had witnesses on our bus and on our panel that really described why Milwaukee has earned, unfortunately, the moniker of Selma of the North. There was deliberate discrimination that created the racial segregation, racial covenants. We had Dr. Bonds testify before our committee that racial covenants were used in Milwaukee to prevent black people from owning homes in certain parts of the city, outside of the city. Also, not only racial covenants, but the FHA, the VA, they would provide loans based on this redlining. And so this was deliberate discrimination. They also talked about the building of the freeway right through the city.
Dividing neighborhoods. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And so not only has this created a housing crisis, but it also created a local transportation problem. I mean, as we preferred highways and freeways and car traffic over public transportation, it sort of substituted for our policy of putting together good public transportation so that people from the inner city of Milwaukee could actually get to the WOW counties, Waukesha, Ozaukee, counties, where Washington counties, where jobs were available. And so it's a transportation problem, it's a housing problem, and it's an economic problem. We also drove past sites like A.O. Smith, where there was once 10,000 people from the inner city. Many of them could walk to work. We visited the Briggs and Stratton abandoned property. We drove past Master Lock, which is still operating in our community. But we were able to see the connection between having really good jobs and being able to have a good middle-class life. As a matter of fact, one of our presenters on the bus, Reggie Jackson, pointed out that at one time, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, had the most thriving black middle class in the entire United States of America. And, of course, now they say that this might be the first, second worst place in the United States for black children to grow up. So how did all that happen? Housing, loss of businesses, when the so-called urban renewal with the freeway, and really the replacement of industrial jobs with mm-hmm. very low wage jobs. I mean, the minimum wage is still $7.25 here in Wisconsin in the United States. And of course, there's nowhere you can live for $7.25 an hour.
And so all of these things coming to a head, and I just want to jump in here and reintroduce you. Democratic U.S. Representative Gwen Moore sits on a House Select Committee working on the wealth gap in America, looking at the housing piece earlier this week in Milwaukee with field hearings. You can join in on Housing 800-642-1234. I'm really curious what you're going to do with this information that you gathered from the bus tour, that you gathered from the hearings in Milwaukee. Where do you take it?
Listen, there's going to be a report. And, you know, I'm very hopeful, very hopeful. There were all kinds of great suggestions that have come up, like having by expanding our housing tax credit programs, like the low-income housing tax credit, the Community Development Block Grant Fund. There is a Milwaukee's United Anti-Displacement Fund, and we do need a housing trust fund, a national housing trust fund, to sort of fill in these gaps between what people can afford to purchase and maintain and what landlords can afford and the cost of housing. And we do need and so on the other side of the break, if we get an opportunity, Kate, I can go into some more of this because we saw
well, I'm
some
curious,
really important things.
I'm curious, too, when you see these skyrocketing home prices, inflation, an affordable housing shortage, so much shortage in quality housing stock, how do you give a leg up to family first-time home buyers or just family home buyers when large investors will swoop in sight unseen and give an all-cash offer?
That I see fires on my doorstep every single day. We have to make sure that we don't create incentives. Excuse me for this.
There's a flyer on your door right now. Go ahead.
All right, there's a flyer on my door right now. But you know, I think it's really, really important that we don't create incentives for investors to do that. And I'm concerned about some of the public policy that's coming down the pike that might inadvertently do it. A lot of public policy has created disadvantages for people.
Well, what policy in particular? I mean, I'm just looking at mortgage applicants. White mortgage applicants are way more likely than non-white applicants to get mortgage loans approved in both majority white neighborhoods and majority non-white neighborhoods. So what role do banks and lenders have in helping to fix this issue?
Well, we do have the Community Reinvestment Act. That was raised as something that was extremely important to make sure that there was equity. And when we mean equity, we don't mean equality. If a person doesn't have the income, no matter what color they are, they shouldn't get a mortgage. But you can work with people, help them clean their credit up, and there are worthy borrowers in every community that deserve something more than predatory loans. The black community really suffered in this last recession in 2007-2008 from predatory lenders. And so the Community Reinvestment Act was raised as a tool to help ameliorate this problem.
Talking with U.S. Representative Gwen Moore, part of a congressional select committee in Milwaukee this week, looking at inequalities in housing and hearing about possible remedies to the historical disparities, the legacy of redlining. What do you want this committee to take back to Washington? Have you had trouble finding affordable housing in Milwaukee? How much is your budget? How much does your budget go to rent or a mortgage? How is it connected to race? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Congresswoman Gwen Moore here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about economic barriers in the Milwaukee region, the work of a House Select Committee trying to address inequities in housing, the increasing gentrification that's breaking apart neighborhoods, tackling the tremendous wealth gap in America through the lens of Milwaukee's North Side. What do you want to tell Congress about housing, about good jobs, about the ability to provide for your family? 800-642-1234. Democratic Congresswoman Gwen Moore of Milwaukee with us for about 9 more minutes. You know, the average Black Milwaukeean is $25,000 less, earning less than the income of a white resident. What role should the federal government have in addressing this disparity?
Well, I do think that wages are the thing that really is not only it's a private sector issue, but the federal government can make interventions as well. I've had a bill for a long time to do what we did during the emergency dollars we put out through the American Rescue Plan, and to enhance the earned income tax credit to try to fill in the gap for that gap between what a person earns and really what is sustainable, so that, you know, so that people always talk about the dignity of work. There's nothing dignified about slavery, you know, working and then really not being able to make ends meet. We spent time on this tour in Kenosha, too, of course. Mm-hmm. Talked about worker training and the importance of doing that. But if you train someone, they need to make more than $16 an hour, or at least that. Especially, and they need to have health care benefits and paid sick leave. These are the kinds of things we were trying to get through with our budgetary package. People called it the Build Back Better package, but to really invest in people, trying to lower the cost of prescription drugs. All of these things may not seem related, but to provide people with work supports really augments their income. If you're spending 30% or more of your income on housing, you are housing burdened. So we definitely need to raise the minimum wage. That's one of the things that the federal government can do. The science is on our side with regard to industry being able to provide an increase and really redistribute some of the monies that they provide as profits and their shareholding. When we passed this last tax bill, it was a really hiatus for shareholders, and we need to share those profits and those benefits with workers. That's really clear. We're hard pressed to really indict landlords for not fixing up homes when they can't get enough rent to do so, and we're hard pressed to indict people for, you know, being behind in their rent and facing eviction when they're rent burdened. So we do need to square things up with increased wages, with the earned income tax credit, and with work supports like, you know, really the Affordable Care Act and lowering insulin drug costs, providing child care, for God's sake, so that people can get to work.
A lot of interconnected issues. I just want to pause right here and bring in Mark with a question. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. In Mequon.
Everybody today on this beautiful day.
Hi, Mark.
Can
yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. So, I mean, you got all these areas, throughout Milwaukee, and it's nationwide. And I'm just wondering what, through the government and people that never paid in for taxes or anything like that, Social Security, and where the problem relies in, we're always in the red in the budget with government and state throughout the nation's debt. And let's bring in Black Lives Matter groups for a minute. They're supposed to come into these neighborhoods and help people out, I thought. I mean, that's what I thought. I thought, hey, we're going to finally get somebody to help these people that need it. And, as far as, and nobody's perfect. And I'm not kicking anybody when they're down. But it seems like we keep going in a circle here, in a vicious circle of life in some of these areas to where nobody, we talk about this year after year after year for decades in elections and this and that. We're going to do this and that. Nobody. And there's a lot of good people out there yet that are helping these people. But, getting back to where the circle of money comes in for taxes and, disabilities and this and that. And, yeah, people do need help. But
Mark, thank you. Yeah, I just want Congresswoman Moore to jump in here. Right. Mark, just not seeing that progress.
Right. Mark makes some very good points. We've been dealing with this for decades and decades. And we've been really ignoring the sort of root causes. There are plenty of people who don't pay taxes for a lot of reasons, and all of us were in that category once upon a time. We were children, and we benefited from public education, as an example. There are people who are disabled. There are people who are elderly that receive Social Security. And so, let's not bash people who don't pay taxes. They pay taxes in other ways, state taxes and other kinds of taxes. But that being said, everybody needs to pay their fair share. I hate to just beat up on Jeff Bezos because God knows I'm grateful every time my Amazon package arrives on time. But, I mean, he pays absolutely no taxes at all. so we need to make sure that the distribution of taxes, and I'm on the tax committee, are fair. And I can tell you that there's a really big difference in and the burden on middle-class families, people like Mark, is huge, which is one of the reasons that on our committee we made sure that nobody who made under $400,000 a year had any sort of tax increases. Because, when you take it from the middle class, we don't want to redistribute wealth from struggling middle class people to poor people. We just want other people. We want to level the playing field. And so, Mark, I take your point. It's true. In terms of housing, we saw a very good project with the old Briggs and Stratton industrial thing, and using some of these same instruments like Opportunity Zones put together by Republican Tim Scott. They are using that with other sorts of city monies and state monies and putting together a project of maybe a couple hundred housing units where they'll have recreation, where they will make sure that people get rents that of no more than 30% of their income to try to help people get on their feet and at least have a stable housing situation so that they can build on that. For having a job and going back to school and raising their kids.
Well, let me
take Mark's point.
Let me ask you this then: what does success look like for your House Select Committee?
Our House Select Committee, from my point of view, we're dealing with not only the housing. We've had other sort of places of inequity. What it'll look like, it'll be sort of a reconciliation. It will be acknowledging some of the inequities that are structural, some of them that have been enabled by federal policy, and that we can correct that. I hope that it will lean toward a sort of reconciliation, because there are plenty of people. The biggest customer in this country to any business is the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And so why can't the federal government distribute its benefit in a way that improves the lives of all Americans. And so when we look at anything, business contracts, housing, construction contracts, anything, we just did housing here because Milwaukee is the epicenter of housing inequity. But if you look at it systemically, a situation where the federal government has put its thumb on the scale, even on labor. You know, we deliberately didn't subject agricultural jobs or domestic kind of jobs or restaurant jobs to the national labor, to the minimum wage. And so who's in those jobs?
And we're going to have to leave it there. Congresswoman Gwen Moore, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Democratic U.S. Representative Gwen Moore of Milwaukee, first elected to Congress in 2004, member of the House Select Committee on Economic Disparity and Fairness and Growth that had field hearings in Kenosha and Milwaukee this week. Ahead this hour, we look at the growing movement of climate change activists on college campuses pushing to have endowments free of fossil fuel investments. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to an audience question about one historical football team.
Gene Jansen wrote to Wisconsin about the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, a semi-pro football team that played for three decades, a mere 25 miles from Lambeau Field. He remembered the team from his youth and hoped to learn more about its history. With his help, WPR's Jenny Peek hit the archives to learn more.
When Gene Jansen was a boy, he spent many Sunday mornings helping ready the field for the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, his town's very own semi-pro football team.
We'd go to the lumber yard, and that's where we'd get the line and at this machine and put the lines up, and all the yard markers had to be 17 and a half inches in from the sidelines, you know. It took a long time because you had 50 yards one way and 50 yards going the other way.
That was in the late 1940s, but the team got its start in 1920. Over the years, the Flying Dutchman played teams across central and northeast Wisconsin, and while the Dutchmen were able to suit up as a team for 30 straight years, other teams came and went.
After the war, there was other teams that had not have a team because of the war, took a lot of their players away. Fortunately, in Little Chute, we were able to keep going because the St. John's High School was giving teams that the players could keep playing. And so a lot of those players went on to play for the Flying Dutchman.
So what were some of the teams the Flying Dutchman played?
The main four teams was Manitowoc Gales, the Two Rivers Ramblers, and Little Chute, and the Merrill Foxes. I think it was, believe, in 1938. Later on was the New London Edisons, the Clintonville Four-Wheeler Drive Truckers, and the Appleton Reds.
But the Dutchmen didn't just play semi-pro teams. Legend has it they also played the Green Bay Packers.
I was able to trace it to 1920. By talking to some of the guys, I heard it was 52-0 that Little Chute got whomped. However, when you read more, it shows where one of the teams actually beat the Packers. I think it was the 1935, you know, like an exhibition game or something like that. The only one of a semi-pro team that ever beat the Packers.
Jansen says fans of the Little Chute Flying Dutchman even tailgated like the Cheeseheads of today.
When they played ball at halftime, where did some of the crowd go at halftime? Where the heck are those guys going? Well, here they're going across the road about a block away, and this guy had a garage, and he had beer in that garage at coolers. And those guys would go over there and get a can of beer, you know. And he had his whole garage lined up with all different kinds of beer cans, different brands. I think that's how he got his collection.
The team disbanded in 1950. Jim Bungers, now 91, played toward the end of the Flying Dutchman's reign.
And I played with Dutchman 47, 48, 49. I played tackle and guard most of the time, both ways, on defense and offense.
But like many of his teammates, Bungers had to eventually say goodbye to football.
In 50, I got married. Well, then football was over with for me. Yeah, I couldn't take a chance on getting hurt more or anything after I got married. Oh, I really enjoyed playing the football net. after you get married that you don't play that anymore.
Now 81, Jansen hopes to pass along some of the history he remembers so fondly.
Like I said, it was crowds, like sometimes 3,000 people at that game, because, you know, years ago, there was no television, you know, and that's how it was. Everybody went to a game. People followed everything. And now it's hard to get people to get involved, even volunteering, you know, it's keep things going that you used to belong to. I love helping people, and I just, this is history that people should know.
You've got to be a football hero to get along with the beautiful girls.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to university endowments and students pressuring their institutions to end financial relationships with the fossil fuel industry. A coalition of students from Yale, MIT, Princeton, Stanford, and Vanderbilt, they took legal action against their universities in February. Closer to home, Marquette University trustees approved an updated investment policy for the university endowment last month, prohibiting any of it from being directly invested in public companies conducting oil or natural gas exploration or extraction. So should higher ed move away from fossil fuel investments? What do you want the Wisconsin universities to do? 800-642-1234. Anne Turlock is an associate professor of management and human resources in the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. And welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, explain what you consider forms of divestment from the fossil fuel industry. What does that mean? What does that look like?
It essentially looks like selling shares, ownership shares that you hold in fossil fuel companies, could be exploration, processing, and then investing it elsewhere. Now, it's not always direct investments where you hold individual shares in individual firms directly. Often endowments are invested in mutual funds where it's a basket of firms that you're invested in, and one sliver of these of this basket could be firms related to the fossil fuel industry or operating in the fossil fuel industry. And it's essentially selling these shares, yes, and investing it elsewhere.
Is it sometimes hard, though, to really truly understand what pieces of the investment are clearly, in the fossil fuel industry, or is it pretty transparent?
Well, it depends to the extent that it's direct investment. So who you hold individual shares in an individual company, that is pretty clear, obviously. Mm-hmm. If it's in a fund, it gets more complicated for sure. Also, it depends on how these funds are constructed. Firms may move in and out if the fund is actively managed. So then it's not always clear if at any certain point in time you hold shares in a fossil fuel company.
Why do you see? I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
And that's different to having a fund that's sort of indexed, that has a set of firms. There might be a certain percentage of fossil fuel firms in there. Yes.
It'd be a whole mix in that particular index basket.
Yes.
So why is divestment being raised on more and more college campuses? Why are we hearing more about it?
I think there is the perception that it could help, that divestment could help in our fight against climate change. And clearly we have to do something there to address climate change. I think there is this thought that back then when there was a divestment movement in the context of apartheid in South Africa, it somehow seemed to help end apartheid. And so there's an analogy drawn often there. Now, that's debatable, though, if really the divestment would lead to reductions in greenhouse gases, which is really what we need to focus on here, among other things. Because ultimately, as you divest, other market participants would just be purchasing those shares that are being divested. And the idea that you defund these fossil fuel companies through divestment is practically not very, it's not very real, it's not very plausible. Is it theoretically possible if about, whatever, 84% of all investable wealth gets divested from fossil fuels, that it would have an effect on their share prices and would defund them, quote unquote? Yes. Is it plausible that 84% of the shares that are out there would be divested? Probably not of the investable wealth.
Companies like BP and ExxonMobil and Shell, they have tons of resources, immense profit and wealth. And that, you know, I think that you're getting at, can divestment from these academic institutions and these nonprofits and others make any meaningful difference, or is this mostly symbolic?
Indeed, yes. So, and on the financial market, it will not make a difference. And I think there is actually more or less consensus around that. And in fact, if you look back to the parallel to the divestment in the context of apartheid, financial markets did not respond. It did not have an effect via financial markets. So then the idea is, might it have an effect through some symbolic action, right? By calling out the destructive nature of fossil fuels, essentially shining a spotlight on the issue. I think you have to carefully think about that. So I think there is not everyone would necessarily agree that fossil fuels are inherently evil. Unlike in the context of apartheid, I think everyone agreed it was inherently evil. There was congressional action around sanctions to sanction the South African economy.
Here's the thing. We all depend on fossil fuels and have for a very long time, I mean, universities included. So if fossil fuel use were to end tomorrow, we'd be in a dire situation. Is there something too hypocritical here about this?
Certainly, that argument has been made quite a bit, that if indeed we feel it's immoral to, or if there are folks that feel it's immoral to profit off of fossil fuels, then the logical consequence would be to boycott the use of fossil fuels, right? Mm. And people will say, well, that's more easily said than done, because fossil fuels companies have put us in a situation where we have no choice but depend on fossil fuels. And that to some extent might be true. At the same time, I feel there is a lot of discretionary use of fossil fuels, some non-necessary use of fossil fuels, the trip that we make out of convenience in the car, right, as opposed to riding our bikes. And so that is certainly true. And then there's also the other question of, if really you feel it's immoral, if we're asking endowments to divest, we have to ask ourselves too, we're asking endowments to divest the money that the donors have entrusted the endowment with, right? The foundation or endowments are asked to act on someone else's call, what to do with the money that the donors gave them. Wouldn't it be more plausible for us to ask those that manage our money to then divest from fossil fuels if we feel that that's needed? And that would be something like our own pension funds, like SWIP, the State of Wisconsin Investment Board. There, I feel it is a little bit more directly linked, right? Because as faculty, for example, is our money.
Let's pause right here with UW-Madison Associate Professor of Management and Human Resources, Anne Turlock, our guide to university endowments and investment ethics. Do you think fossil fuel investments conflict with the mission of universities, or should their portfolios be free to have a mix of energy assets? What do you think of students suing their institutions over fossil fuel investments? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Ann Turlock here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Universities have been under pressure from their students to scrutinize their pension funds and endowments, untangle them from fossil fuels. And just last month, Marquette's trustees voted to phase out any fossil fuel-related endowment investments. But the university also made clear its current investment portfolio does not include any direct public investments in fossil fuels. How do you want your alma mater to approach this? 800-642-1234. UW-Madison Associate Professor of Management and Human Resources, Ann Turlock, is with us for about nine more minutes. And let's look closer to the UW. There's a coalition of 11 groups on six UW system campuses pushing for fossil fuel divestment. What have you seen out of the UW to the response to this?
Well, there's two sides to the response. So there's the Faculty Senate, right, that has passed a resolution asking the same thing, that the foundation divest. On the foundation side, they have responded that they will not divest. They feel that the donors entrust them with their money, the donors' money, and they have an obligation to invest that money in the donors' interests, which is to essentially balance risk return and provide for stable returns that can then support the UW's operations and the teaching and the scholarships and professorships that are often, in fact, used to research and teach in climate change and how to transition into a clean economy.
I think I was just going to say right there what you said. That is a pretty tricky problem that universities are also grappling with. You know, they have this money coming in, large donations from the energy industry, funding research labs, as you mentioned, funding positions and things like that. That there is also very sensitive and tricky with money from the energy industry.
And I don't know how much the energy industry functions as a donor to endow gifts with the foundation. I think there the financial connection would more be through grants that are given to research labs, I think. It is more that those that do give, so it's often alumni that give money, alumni, and it is not, I think if the foundation heard their donors say, we do not want you to invest in fossil fuels, they would listen to that because they feel that it is their responsibility to act in the donor's interest, right? And the donor's interest is to use that money to optimally support the UW-Madison. And by categorically excluding a whole set of investments, the foundation worries that they may not be able to do that. Now, foundation also does not have any direct investments in fossil fuel companies. So in a way, they could, just like many of the other campuses, say, oh, well, we actually already are divested. We will not invest, or we have followed the call. But I think there is a notion of it being a little bit misleading, and because it would be misleading because they don't have direct investment because it's just not aligned with how they invest their investment strategy, as opposed to them not having any stakes directly in fossil fuel companies because the divestment movement told them not to. So it would be a misleading statement.
So what about the litigation? Students at five large universities, Yale, Princeton, MIT, Stanford, Vanderbilt, suing their schools for violating the Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act. What do you see there?
I do not believe that any of these suits have moved forward. We would need to look a little bit more closely on how the endowments are managed in those schools. So for UW, the foundation is a separate entity from the university, entirely separate, such that there is no governance relationship there between the university and the foundation. That is not always the case for other universities, where it could be, and I'm not a legal expert there, where it could be that suits brought forward by students, faculty, whatever, that directed at the foundation or their endowment have more merit, you know, because there's a direct relationship, but there is none. There is the governance body of the foundation for UW-Madison is entirely separate from the governance body of the University of Wisconsin.
Talking with Ann Turlock, who's an associate professor of management, human resources at the Wisconsin School of Business, teaches courses on corporate social responsibility and sustainable business as we look at this issue, 800-642-1234, this issue of divestment. So can shareholders, do you think, apply pressure to fossil fuel companies without divesting? Are there other paths here rather than just divesting?
Absolutely. And there is a lot of voice that says actually through active ownership, through what's called shareholder activism, we could have a much larger, much more impact. It would move beyond it being a symbolic action because we could, as shareholders, file resolutions or suggest directors to the board of directors that then have a voice in the company. And in fact, we have seen that more and more happening. There are teeny, what's called activist funds that have succeeded in coordinating with the larger shareholders of a certain, of Exxon, that's a big example there, and have placed three directors onto the board of Exxon. And so they're now being able to then guide that firm's actions a lot more effectively. Because again, just by divesting, you just hand those shares to another investor and don't really affect the company per se.
And before we have to go here, do you see the push for divestment growing on campuses, or might this diminish? What do you see in your crystal ball?
I think for now it will continue, and that is worrisome to me because to me, if it was a symbolic action that comes without cost, I would say why not? But I do feel there is a cost because it does distract from what I feel could be much more effective action against climate change. And for example, if we were to focus all that energy on lobbying, perhaps for a price on carbon, you know, that to me would have much bigger impact, or focus on more shareholder activism, that too could have a bigger impact. And so I worry about the opportunity costs here.
Anne, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Anne Turlock, Associate Professor of Management and Human Resources. We have a link to an evening of fossil fuel divestment conversation. You can find that link at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.